Roll call, please.
Bruce Rinker.
Here.
Dan Moore.
Here.
Two members are present, which constitutes a quorum.
Please join us in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First order of business, if we can have a motion to approve the minutes of our meeting of July 19th, subject to any amendment.
So moved, I guess. I seconded as well.
No, I'll second it. We'll give you a reprieve there. All in favor? Aye. And I think it might make sense for us to adjust the agenda, amend it, to allow for the swearing in of our three patrol officers. And without any further ado. Yeah, please introduce them.
Springsteen concert.
Hey, good morning, everybody. Another great day for the Cleveland Metro Parks Police Department. First of all, I want to thank all the members of the Cleveland Metro Parks PD that have showed up here to support our newest hires as we bolster the ranks and continue to get bigger and bigger. It's a great day. So thank you very much, all of you, for coming. As your chief, I sincerely appreciate it. And I know I speak for the new hires. It means a lot to these guys to have you here supporting it. So we're going to swear in Mohammed. Today, Mohammed comes to us. He was actually, interesting note, an immigration attorney in Egypt before he came to the United States and became a policeman. So he comes from the Highland Hills Police Department. Adam Murray is joining us from the Cleveland Police Department, and Tim Rice from Jackson Township, who's been there 15 years and is currently a canine officer there, but I would assume shortly leaving and then starting with us here. So Commissioner Rinker, they're all yours, sir.
Gentlemen, come forward. You get cheat sheets and you turn it on. You would raise your right hand when you repeat after me. I,
I'm done with your mom.
Do solemnly swear.
Solemnly swear.
That I will support the Constitution and laws of the United States of America.
That I will support the Constitution and law of the United States of America.
The Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
The Constitution and laws of the state of Ohio.
And the rules and regulations.
And the rules and regulations.
Of Cleveland Metro Parks.
Cleveland Metro Parks.
And I will discharge the duties.
And I will discharge the duties.
To the best of my ability.
To the best of my ability.
Of the office of patrol officer.
Of the office of patrol officer.
To which I've been appointed.
To which I've been appointed.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
I will faithfully carry out and implement.
Policies enunciated.
Policies enunciated.
And the instructions given to me.
And instruction given to me.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
By the Board of Park Commissioners.
Of the Cleveland Metropolitan Park District.
Of the Cleveland Metro Park and Park District.
And this I promise to do.
This I promise to do.
As I shall answer to God.
As I shall answer to God.
Congratulations.
Tim Wall, Adam Sine, would you like to introduce your family that came with you today, please?
Yes, I would like to introduce my wife, Julie, my daughter, Emily, and her friend, Allie.
Congratulations and welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to introduce who you want to do?
Yes,
welcome. Mohammed, would you like to introduce your guests?
I have here a lot of people. So I have my
chief right there, Chief Campbell.
I'm Dylan Golston. They are working with Allen Health. And I have my two partners. We work together with the Enzo Tour and my visitor around Eddie. Thank you guys for coming.
Well.
Recommended actions is on the top of page 9, appointing Mohammed Mohammed, Adam Murray, and Timothy Rice as full-time police officers for Cleveland Metro Parks as authorized under section 1545.113.
Move the motion.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Now, I know you'd love to stay for the financial report, but I'll give you a couple minutes to clear the place if you wish. Not to disparage the.
They never stay.
I think you sort of encouraged them to leave.
Thank you. All right, we're good. Sir?
Thank you. Got a pointer. Good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to present this financial report through the first 7 months. And I'll give you a quick preview. It's really good. So that's positive. First page. I just wanted to go to the highlight right now. You can see top line property taxes worth $13 million. Roughly ahead of where we were through 7 months of 2022, which is 26.6%. We had not completed the second half collection. We received our final check of the second half collection just this past week on Tuesday from the Cuyahoga County Fiscal Officer. It was just under $33 million. And the long and the short of it are when I report in September through August, we're going to be almost exactly where we had projected to be with our new revenue collections. In fact, 2.9% above what was budgeted or projected. And that was by design. You'll remember me mentioning I'm going to reduce it a couple percent just to be conservative. But at the end of the day, we came in almost exactly where we thought we would be. So that is really, really good news. And then I would just point out that right now we're running about $12 million ahead of where we were, primarily driven by the property tax collections. And now we'll jump into some of the detail because we've got some fun things to talk about here too. First, zoo admissions are up about 0.5% over where they were last year through 7 months. So I would say the zoo's having a good year. It had a good year last year. It's very, very, very steady performer. You will note here, the Zoo Society had revenue last year in July, no revenue this year. We're down about $1 million. That's all due to timing. We got our Cleveland Zoological Society check for July a little bit late. So we received $1.13 million from the Zoo Society in the first week of August. So when I report in September through the end of August, that number there will have almost no variance. It'll true up. They're running fairly consistently. The same thing happened in refreshments here. This is timing. That's up so much because the Aramark payment that should have been received in July was received in should have been received in June, was received in July. So you can see the year to date is almost spot on in terms of refreshments. But if you look at things on a month-to-month basis, which we do, often when something in a previous year would hit at the last week of a month and then the next year that hits in the first week, that throws that off. So all in all, the zoo is doing extremely well. We're very happy with the performance, and some of the differences that you see are just due to timing. Next, golf. At a high level, let's just start with to my page here. Greens fee revenue is up 20.6%. Rounds played are up 21%. Or as Joe Rozek likes to say, that's 36,000 rounds of golf were up through the first 7 months, over 36,000 rounds of golf. Year-to-date golf revenue is up 23.9%. And year-to-date expenses are up only 13.8%. That's a great recipe for success. You can see that's what's driving this right here. Year-to-date operating revenue is up over 50%. It's just, there's not much to say about golf. We'll look at a couple of the individual courses, but all are doing well. I did want to highlight this because we are spending some capital dollars in our golf course operations, which we've talked about, primarily driven by all the work that's being done at Manikiki. And we've talked about that in previous meetings. The individual golf courses that I did want to mention, oh, the commissioner gets that shut.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Sleepy Hollow, you can see, is up dramatically. The rounds played at Sleepy are up 23%. So 23% increase in rounds drives that to almost over a half million dollar surplus through the first 7 months compared to what it was last year. And then the real star performer year to date is Seneca. The rounds played at Seneca are up over 30%, which it was always a strong performer. You can see what it did last year through 7 months. Now it's almost $800,000. And as I looked at off my script a little bit, as I looked at how our golf courses do, I continue to be surprised and impressed because you read about golf courses that can't make money and have to shut down. All of our courses make money. All of them do well. Our golf course operation is just extremely well run. They're just doing a great job.
Thanks.
And then the last subgroup is our enterprise funds. And you can see that concessions are up year to date over here, 28.3%. Year to date total revenues are up 16.8% and expenses are up 9.73%. And again, another recipe for success. If your revenue increases at a higher percentage than your expense increase, that's going to drop more to the bottom line. You can see operating surplus last year and enterprise was just under 300,000. Now it's 577,000 through 7 months. And a big part of this concession revenue in July and year to date is driven by Merwin's, which we'll look at on the next page. Look at what Merwin's is doing. Last year at this point, it was, you know, they were getting things trued up. They clearly have them trued up now. Year to date, over $113,000 in net operating revenue. They're just doing extremely well.
Is it fair to say a lot of this is just really leveling off in many ways from COVID?
I would say maybe even more than leveling off. We're seeing an increase. It's the service levels, it's the food offerings, it's the environment. Many places have leveled off. Merwin's is actually exceeding leveling off and it's doing better.
Pent up.
Yeah, maybe pent up. That's a good way to put it. And then I did want to point out parking, which we talk about every month. You can see it's almost a guaranteed 39,000. It's between $35,000 and $39,000 in gross revenue per month on average through the year. And it's been consistent for years now. And it just, the nice thing is that provides additional revenue that can then be rotated back into other parts of the organization for other operations. And that's all we had. The other thing I wanted to see if there were questions on the year-to-date operating results. Normally at this point, we also talk about the budget to let you know we've kicked the budget off. For the commissioner's knowledge and staff know this, in the past, our budget process was about 22 weeks in duration. We've shortened that. It seemed incredibly long. It is incredibly long. So we've shortened that down to about 16 weeks. And so the budget process will really start in earnest right after Labor Day for our staff. All of your information will be coming to you in the same time frame. But knowing that August was such a busy month, it just didn't seem to make sense to me ask field staff to be thinking about budget work and doing budget work when August is our last big month of summer leading up to Labor Day. So we'll be having budget conversations in the next few months as we get that going.
Very well. Thank you. Any question? You good?
Sounds good.
New business.
New business. Just as a point of clarification, we did swear in our patrol officers as the first item. So Muhammad Muhammad, Adam Murray, and Tim Rice are sworn in. The next item we have is a retiring guest. Unfortunately, Jerry was unable to be here. But you know, Jerry served the park district for more than 30 years. Again, you see the nice progression from handyman all the way up to senior tech lead. Continuously sought ways to improve himself, worked between Euclid, Seneca, Big Met Paving Projects, always was willing to lend a hand. And it says, would always go above and beyond the call of duty to assist in any crisis, cleaning, repair damage. He is a true team player and we will be definitely missing his talents, but we wish him well in his retirement. The recommended action recognizing Gerald A. Rapp for his years of service falls on the top portion of page 10.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Next is 2023 budget adjustment number 8. Wade?
Thank you, Brian. Budget adjustment number 8 is on page 10. The detail for it is on page 43 through 46. The adjustment is for $7,248,605. I would like to raise up that $6,172,476 of that adjustment is for capital projects, which had been anticipated. We just provided the budget. The cash is already in hand and has been collected. A couple of the larger items, if you were to look at the detail, would be $2 million that's been appropriated for the Hinkley Dam work, $750,000, which has been appropriated for the Manikiki Cart Barn, $400,000 for the Padua Shelter Rehab, $400,000 for the East 55th Community Sailing Center, $300,000 for Irish Bend, Lake Link Trail Design are just a few. There are 21 different projects that we've included in this adjustment because it's work that was planned and now we budgeted for it with the revenue in hand.
Thank you.
Move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
The next action item is it's amendments to the purchase and sale agreements. This is with Marlin Investment Group. This the board had seen, you know, well over a year ago. Kyle and the team continue to work back and forth to find ways to essentially handle the closing date. The sale leaseback option has all been agreed upon. They are looking at opportunities to either build and or buy existing. And so we have worked very hard to allow for this basically transaction and transition to go hopefully very smoothly going forward. We have basically put in all of the different measures if they decide to leave early. And so it is basically capturing all of the data that allows for this transaction to continue to move forward. The recommended action falls on the bottom portion of page 11. For the Marlin purchase and sale agreements with Marlin Investments Group, LLC, that is detailed in the board agenda in the middle portion of page 11, really the periods of time that we worked on negotiating.
If possible, instead of before we move this particular motion, can we look at the next one too? Because I think to see them in sequence is pretty.
For sure.
Yeah.
So the next action item, if David wants to pull up, is the contract. The last portion that sits on here is the City of Cleveland parcel, 0.45 acres that of land here, and this is our trail right here. So we have the opportunity, this is our maintenance facility here. We have the opportunity now to connect all the way through here. This is Canal Basin Park here. We go into the city property, RTA property, sewer district property, then RTA property, and all the way to the flats. Why that's so uniquely significant is because that can become then what we would call a riverfront trail access all the way to Columbus Avenue. So we work very hard at acquiring. We've also split this part in multiple purchase agreements to look at a development option as well. So it really starts to put form and function together of what we're trying to accomplish with our partners.
Yeah, I mean, without being too hokey, you've got Gravity Place, and this is kind of a center of gravity. We look at that peninsula, Irish Town Bend, the towpath, the Lake Link, the lakefront, spreading out the Cheers project we're going to talk about. I mean, it's just for the last 10, 12 years, this is really huge. It's a big consolidation.
In a century of stewardship, this is a very unique opportunity from what was once an industrial area. If we look at the Irish Town Bend that's on the opposite side and the $60+ million that will be put together to basically buffer and stabilize that and then become, you know, a world-class park. You've literally got these assets that will be all linked together. Certainly our partners at the Foundry here are on the bottom corner of here. Ultimately, you know, we would like to see either an on-road version all the way over to the stadium district eventually. So that would be the ultimate goal of creating a continuous river walk opportunity here in Cleveland.
Everyone's got to be commended pulling this together. It's huge. So I'm sorry, but yeah, we go back to the
original. So we will go back to D, which is the amendment to purchase and sale agreements for Marlin Investment falls on the bottom portion of page 11.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
The next action item falls on the top portion of page 13 for this fee simple title of 3.3 acres from cereal food processors.
Move the motion.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
The next is Cleveland Harbor Eastern Embayment Resilience Strategy. This is the authorization of local match in support of the Port of Cleveland's grant submittal to the Federal Highway Transportation. This is called the PROTECT, Promoting Resilient Operations for Transformative, Effective, and Cost-Saving Transportation. Wow. PROTECT. This is the discretionary program grant. I have to be very honest, this team is really pushing this project forward with our project partners between the Port of Cleveland, Cleveland Metro Parks, City Administration, City Council, ODOT, Ohio Department of Natural Resources, the Army Corps. It literally has the host of assembled governments that include NOAACA as well. This project, essentially, if you can start to see the map up on top here of what this will be providing, it is a very unique opportunity to provide for a grant that will literally help start to make this become a reality. So if you go from the east part of the East 55th Marina, you look at the different ways that this will start to bring itself together. This is really that next step. It requires a 20% local match. It is broken out from $44 million from Federal Highway, ODOT, their portion, NOAACA has committed, and Cleveland Metro Parks really working to pull this opportunity forward is probably one of the most unique opportunities, you know, a park district will ever get. It is getting a lot of national attention. We are certainly working with all of our elected officials to make sure that hopefully we can be successful. This grant authorization is for the Cleveland Metro Parks to commit $2.8 million as part of the local match for the Port of Cleveland's application to the Federal Highway Administration.
And not to put anyone on the spot, but on a good day, first getting approval for all the funding, the timeframe for that, and then for actual execution, we're talking about how many years?
I would hate to commit like a timeframe based on regulations and others, but yeah. It's incrementally keep working.
Right.
If Sean can tie in, I would be remiss.
Like I said, on a good day, aspirationally.
So in this board meeting, we have the information that again,
whole holistic update.
Understood.
Technically, these funds could be ready in 25 for this portion. And then we've actually got a figure that will show you how over a 20 to 25 year period, the project could be built out from when it starts.
But which, just want everyone to understand 20, 25 years, we're not talking something overnight, but
correct.
It's how you have to plan to execute.
And in sequencing, just so we understand it, on the left would be the first part.
So what we're talking about in terms of the action item that's in front of you is actually the portion in the middle, Breakwater A. So that's what the PROTECT grant will fund. This portion here.
Yeah.
And then in terms of sequence of fill, so we'll be talking about a next NOAA grant that will construct the view portion here on the left.
So you, if you build Breakwater A, don't you have to, doesn't it just swirl around behind it then? How do you?
It doesn't, Breakwall A, so what this image doesn't show is the Cleveland Harbor Breakwall.
Yeah.
Which ends approximately here. Most of the impacts to I-90 occur here, and the PROTECT grant is to literally help to protect I-90 from those nor'easters.
So right.
We modeled that this piece would be the first and most impactful to build on its own.
So if the breakwall ends there on a northeaster is the worst storm climate.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
The nor'easter.
That is when we see I-90 having the issues of be shut down and literally shoveling fish off the highway.
Which justifies $44 million of investment.
Yes, to start.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's very creative.
Yeah.
To be able to build a breakwall on the basis of protecting, not having to invest in a new sheet wall piling to protect the interstate. So that's a very creative as I've ever seen.
Something new, right?
But it's 25 years. That's
patience is great.
Yeah, right.
Recommended action falls on the mid portion of page 14, committing the Board of Park Commissioners the 2.8 million for the our part of the local match.
Move the motion.
Second, all in favor?
Aye.
The next
The next action item is Garfield Boulevard Green Infrastructure. This is an authorization of grants submitted to the Green Infrastructure Grant Program, otherwise known as GIG. We offer, we have worked with MEORSD in many opportunities. This is again a very unique way. Sean can probably come back in and fill in any details that you would need, but we will seek up to $300,000 for the green infrastructure project. This is again a tie-through with Cuyahoga County, the city of Garfield, all along the Garfield Boulevard. It is a tremendous opportunity to really enhance our sustainability model and then really connect what we would call our connector coming off the Cuyahoga, the towpath trail, all the way up into Garfield Park. So the box in the bottom corner under Garfield Boulevard, that is the project area right there.
Boy, it's impressive when you see how this starts linking together, knitting together all these neighborhoods that have been disparate over the years.
Essentially, this would be part of a road diet plan to actually shrink the road, actually tip in the green infrastructure, build the trail, and make the connection all the way up from the towpath to connect Garfield Park.
And that would be alongside the road or in the road?
Yeah, off. I think it's offset one. They'll close one lane in the rebuild. It looks like a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Recommended action falls in the top portion of page 15.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
The next is a Big Creek Reservation authorization to submit. There's a couple of these, municipal bridge fund application to the Ohio Department of Transportation. This is for the mid-year 2023 round of municipal bridge funds. We have selected two bridge projects, project program funds, 80% of the eligible costs. We are continuing to hopefully be successful with this. We'll work with Arcadis for the bridge inspection. We'll continue to move this forward. This is a 24-foot span, four-sided precast box frame bridge. It has a poor condition rating, which is largely due to the delamination. So we continue to fill the buckets of funding to help fix some of the critical infrastructure along the way. This is, again, Big Creek Parkway. We would be committing approximately $350,000. We're going to request $1.965 million. Recommended action falls in the mid-portion of page 16.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Very similarly in Millstream Run, this is again an authorization to submit. This is part of Royal View Lane. This goes up into the successful mountain biking hiking area. This is again another very similar application, 83-foot span. Bridge was constructed back in 1975. So we'll continue to work on any of the bridge scenarios that are in that poor condition. This is a request for $1.990 million, matching with $405,000 of Cleveland Metro Parks Fund. This is in the Royal View Lane and the Millstream Run Reservation, same grant program, the Municipal Bridge Program. Recommended action falls on the mid-portion of page 17.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
The next is the Cleveland Lakefront Bikeway. This is East 9th to East 55th. This is the PDA Project Development Agreement. Cleveland Metro Parks and its partners have worked very hard for a number of years. The commissioners may remember back in 2015 through a partnership with NOACA and the Transportation for Livable Communities, the Campus District, St. Clair Superior Development Corporation, the Warehouse District, authored a study which was presented here in front of the board almost 8 years ago. Again, these things do take time. The stars have aligned essentially to be able to pull a multi-use path all the way from 9th to 55th Street. This is one of the first steps really in the CHEERS opportunity to bring people all the way through. NOACA has committed $5.6 million worth of funding. Cuyahoga County has been running this project. We have been working with the city of Cleveland as well. We are very proud to be able to announce to the board the Jack Joseph and Morton Mandel Foundation included an allocation of $5 million of construction money to build this bikeway, again, from East 55th. What this does is connects the Cleveland Brown Stadium, Rock Hall, Science Centers to assets in University Circle, the Cultural Gardens, our East 55th, and the CHEERS project ties in all the museums and Case Western Reserve. This is a project development agreement that we're working out with the Public Works and Cuyahoga County Planning. Everybody has been absolutely fantastic and on board with this. So it's an agreement to commit up to $5 million worth of funds and the project development agreement with Cuyahoga County. Recommended action falls on the bottom portion if there are no questions on page 18.
Do you have that on a map?
It should be on page 53. Yeah, if David can bring it up.
These partnerships are phenomenal.
I think, again, the tie-in and the significance of what this, you know, along with the work that has been done to complete the towpath and what the Rotarians had done in their rapid beautification for years, including the Red Line Greenway, and then you see the Warner Hill connection, you're starting to see these, as Bruce noted, the spurs that are connecting off of the spine, which is, I think, really, you know, a really good way of showing how this community can connect. And when you look at the green, essentially is the project area all the way out to our East 55th Marina. The purple that sits on there, this section here is essentially complete in fashions. Gordon Park sits here. And then you have the cultural garden trail all the way down through. And as the commissioners noted, we will take over this in the early part of October, which will then create another opportunity for a green buffer along this trail system here, and enhanced as part of the Jack Joseph and Mort Mandel gift, over $8 million to rebuild South Gordon Park.
Brian, as we cut through Lakeside and the other marina to the right of
Forest,
of that.
Yeah, City.
How does that work then? So we're moving in on their territory.
I think not quite yet. I think the work that we're trying to do is to understand the relocation of utilities, fire hydrants, pools, fences, airports. So what I would say right now is hold tight. We're finishing kind of the draw through line. So when we get there, we'll bring it back to the board.
I think the important part about this is really aiming high. Before, we were going to be on the other side of the freeway, which was just, you know, nowhere near as nice as what we've got here. This is terrific.
Keep in mind, there was two options. There was a north marginal and a south marginal side. There may still be at some point in time. Yeah. The challenge, I think, is, you know, when you start to put the pieces of the puzzle together and you look at Interbelt 4, IB4, Dead Man's Curve coming through, the rebuild of that, we have inserted ourselves into good conversations with ODOT and the feds. You know, is there a way on that south side of the interchange to pull a trail through from downtown? So from potentially the municipal lots where the tennis courts, the old tennis courts sit, and those, is there another way to do that? Or how do we get over the top? So there's a lot of unique things in play of that puzzle. But having said that, staying on the north side is the easiest way right now to actually make that connection.
Has there been any drawings showing any adjustment to the angle of Dead Man's Curve? I mean, I know that had been talked about.
It has definitely been talked about, to and include some of the land where the Cleveland Mounted Police Station would be, of how they would try to soften that turn. So it's not quite, I mean, it's a 90 degree turn on 90. So I think they're trying to figure out how to soften that. I have not, and I don't think we've seen any designs. It's not funded yet, but it's definitely, you know, ties itself all the way through the success of downtown, of how the freeway is currently offset a little bit. So that recommended action, committing the partnership project development agreement with Cuyahoga County and committing up to $5 million in funds, falls on the bottom portion of page 18.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
The next is change order number 2, contract 1621, Susie's Bear Hollow, as we're bringing this project to completion. This dates back to 2021. This is change order number 2. It's in the amount of $161,614.99. It's just part of the guaranteed maximum price. It's kind of the final things, privacy fence, drainage, revision to the fire alarm, a host of things, hopefully cleaning this up. There may be one more yet just to finish this out, but we're happy to bring back change order number 2, working for a grand opening next Friday. Recommended actions on top portion of page 20.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
The award of award of bids, RFPs, co-op, single sources, and is on page 21. I will not go through all of them, but eucalyptus pavement, third party electric, Manikiki irrigation system, a new semi trailer. Ours is starting to look very aged. Trencher assembly for the project at Manikiki, and 11 upfits, 4-wheel drive, Ford Explorers for the police department, all fall in the recommended actions on page 21.
Move the motion.
Second. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Vouchers.
Resolution 23-08-124 is on page 39 for approval of vouchers, wire transfers, and payroll for the month. The total amount is $12,768,180.39. All expenditures have been reviewed for legality and conformity with Ohio Revised Code.
Move approval.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
We now turn to our public comments. I think we have three people identified, no particular order. So we'd love to hear from you. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Laura McShane. I'm amazed. Today is like good news after good news after good news. But one of the things I would really like to see is the Metro Parks take the lead in the strategy for transit plus trails coordination. I'm aware of the fact that the NOAC and the city of Cleveland have not been successful in recent RAISE grants and other major federal applications, and the secret sauce is the Metro Parks. Please, I'm asking you to take a lead. Finish the Red Line Greenway. It's a key linkage. It's really the mobility linchpin for all of the promising things you've presented today. And I know other regions are going to be looked at. I mean, I just came from Austin, which is miserably hot. And, you know, we are compared to Austin a lot, but frankly, I'd rather live here. But some of the other things that happen do disturb me. But there's also a national push for transit plus trails. And Senator Cory Booker and U.S. Congressman James Gomez have submitted legislation, the Trails Act, the Transit Plus Trails Act. It's not called Transit Plus Trails Act. I mean, it's called, Transit to Trails Act, Transit to Trails. So our strategic advantage as a region is that we have the greater RTA. I think in terms of management, you're way better, but I'm really hoping that there's a partnership to work on those multimodal connections and really take into account winter, where I came before this group about a year ago to talk about how you actually maintain the all-purpose trails, that people in wheelchairs and people who walk, it's not just all about bikes, can use year-round. So that is the strategic advantage to transit plus trails, and I'm just really hoping that you take the lead.
Thank you,
by the way, for I walked here, as you know. I live here. I take advantage. The Brookside Park, by the way, is just exploding with activity. You know, every day there are people who use it as their primary form of exercise. But
Lord, you would say though that the Metro Park system is far better than the Austin system.
My mom lives in Lakeway, Texas. I don't know if you've ever been there, but they have a phenomenal trail system because of people like my stepfather, who was one of the originators in the community. The Hamilton Trail is amazing. I neglect to mention that the water access is, which I credit Brian for his work. I mean, our region didn't have access to water, and Lakeway has Lake Travis, but right now it's like a puddle. It's so dried up. It's insane. So kudos to all, especially your top-notch grants committee. You know, I worked here and I wrote grants, not when I worked here, but when I worked, I was one of the founding board members for West Creek Conservancy and on the grants team. And the amazing Dick Kerber here, and when I worked with the amazing Bob Graytek at West Creek on grant applications, we were always looking for a strategic advantage. This region has all the strategic advantages. I just think we don't capitalize on it.
You're right. I think supporting organizations make this community phenomenal. And I think the Metro Park has been a nucleating agent that has pulled all this together. But I mean, it's hard even to begin to compare Austin, Texas to Northeastern Ohio in terms of trails.
Well, they're trying to catch up on transit. That's for sure. You know, I mean, they recognize that people are isolated, stranded. You cannot get around. Here, I can, I mean, the Garfield news is such is so exciting to me, because Garfield is one of the original Cleveland parks that was, you know, the Metro Parks took over the management. It's an amazing park. And I mean, now I take the 18, I take transit a lot. The 18 from Metro Health goes right to Garfield Park. So I'm excited now. I mean, I can walk, I can make an even bigger loop. I'm training. I'm trying to walk the whole canal way from New Philadelphia up to Cleveland. So I'm training.
Doesn't hurt to get a bicycle.
What's that? I do bike, but I don't really like biking anymore.
Thank you. Marty?
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, now you've had all your praise, so you can listen to Marty. When the agreement for the Riverfront Trail was discussed here in June of 22, the description was of 1,700 feet along the western bank of the Cuyahoga. Now land is being acquired on the east side, with Metro Parks becoming a major landowner. As a partner with Flats Ford, along with the commercial company Riverfront Property Holdings, Inc., which has Nick Catanzarite as an officer. Metro Parks has had real estate dealings with the Catans in Strongsville. Metro Parks is committed to spending a lot of money buying this riverfront land without any grant guarantees and to utilize that land for 15 years. Wow, so many questions. Metro Parks is now going to be a landlord and be responsible for leasing, supervising, and enforcing whatever agreements they reach with the leftovers. Is this really what our park district was intended for? You're already facing difficulties with the Marlin agreement. That does not bode well for these other parcels. You've just emerged from major legal difficulties with Tony George. Now is not the time to take on other real estate complexities. Not to mention the issue of whether, when a property owner has approached the park and there is no public competition, the conditions for executive session are met. You say that this trail is driven by public demand. If you're so responsive to public opinion, then for heaven's sakes, listen to the outcry and do something to preserve housing at Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park. Surely Councilman Polensic is very used to choosing budget priorities and thus should not be distracted by shiny things. Yet he chose the flashy attraction of the barge over the needs of his own constituents. At the same time, he is vocal about crime and police staffing. That is a real and justifiable need. Similarly, Metro Parks does not need to control the riverfront properties downtown. You are barely handling your own police staffing, barely holding your own on police staffing with ever increasing demands. Maybe more pay would bring more people. Stop pouring taxpayer dollars into land deals. Share the Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park land. Share the Euclid Beach Mobile Home Park land. Put your money where the real priorities are and ante up to protect the safety and homes of your supporters. Thank you.
I think we have another, maybe two.
Good morning.
Morning.
My name is William Hart, and it's an honor for me to be able to stand here before each and every one of you who have made such a positive effect and a life-changing difference in so many people's lives, culture, and the environment as a whole. I thank you. I'm here on behalf of the residents of the Euclid Beach Mobile Park, and I'm a resident as well there. As you all know, what is transpiring at the mobile park, Euclid Beach Mobile Park, first let me say this. We are very, very, very pleased to know that the Euclid Beach Mobile Park is being turned over to you guys at the Metro Park, because they are truly joined together at the hip, the mobile park and the Metro Park. So we are pleased to know that. But for the last year and a half, we have been in the dark as to where we're going to go, where we're going to live at, where we're going to land at after this transpires, take place. We don't know anything. We haven't been told anything. Everything that's been told to us has not been true, about where we're going to live at the Metro Park. We were very, 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 yesterday we had a meeting inside the park. Everybody was extremely happy to know that the Metro Parks was taking over the park. Because with that, we know one thing, we're going to be respected. We're going to have somewhere, you guys are going to make sure that we have somewhere safe to go. No matter what they say about that mobile park, we was crime free for over 10 years. No crime whatsoever in that mobile park. Outside the fact that a few people might drink a little alcohol and get loud in the streets and somebody call the police or something like that. But as far as crime go, there was no crime there. We lived a peaceful life. And now it's been uprupted because of somebody purchased the land. They told us they were going to build condominiums there. They was going to do all this for the wealthy people. We didn't know what they were going to do or how we were going to be, how our future looked, how what it looked like for us to lay our head in a place where we would call home. We didn't know where that would be at. But now, with the hope that you guys have taken over the mobile park, and we understand the importance of converting that over into green land. We truly understand that. But we want us to be thought about as well. Where are we going to call home at? A lot of those people, a lot of the people that live there are elderly people, and they don't have what you would call that the house, the mobile homes that they live in ain't worth nothing, but to them it's worth everything. And you just can't take them people and put them out on the streets. And the purchasers of that land, that's how they felt. All they was concerned with was taking that land and developing into something and moving these people out, moving us out into the streets. And so now we are extremely happy, and I wanted to come here and I wanted to thank everyone, each and every one of you, for making the choice of receiving that park. From what they told us, they're giving it to you guys. But we know that with you guys, with the deed of that property, that you would make sure that not just myself or my neighbor, but the entire family of people live there will have somewhere safe to go, and it won't be a strain. Because one lady made a statement. She said that, well, if they gave me $5,000, I'll be able to go. You won't be able to even live 1 month off of $5,000. That's how far off she is from what really is going on in society. So it's just people like you that's going to have to make decisions for people like her and make sure that that place, wherever she go to, that she'll have a place where she can really call home, like she called her house now, her mobile home, her home. And not just her, but all of us. And with that, I thank each and every one of you. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe there was another gentleman.
Commissioner, before that, we have our next speaker. And Mr. Hart, thank you for your comments and complimentary words towards the Cleveland Metro Parks. You know, I'm in regular communication with Western Reserve Land Conservancy and their legal counsel. And yes, the community planning discussion and Western Reserve's comments are that eventually their hope is to transfer the property to us, but that has not been finalized. That is still something that is in the future. But Western Reserve has assured us, and it is our understanding there have been meetings, and there was just a meeting 2 weeks ago with all of the tenants. And while details initially were not as specific, and sometimes there was not much information, and Western Reserve acknowledges that with the announcement of the grant funds that have recently become available, Western Reserve was able to meet with the tenants to begin that dialogue and process of meeting with each tenant and resident to discuss what their plans look like. And they are still analyzing the issue of the application of the Uniform Relocation Act. So there's a lot still in the works, and I think the looking at this in a just manner, Western Reserve Land Conservancy has assured us that that is their central focus, but is premature for us, the Cleveland Metro Parks, to weigh in when this while it's talked about, it is not a transaction that has happened, and is still there are many, many details to it.
Rose, could you explain what the Uniform Relocation Act is? Is it a federal?
Yes, it is a federal law, and when under certain circumstances, it would be required to be applied. Now, in the situation that is present with the Western Reserve Land Conservancy, they're a private entity, and no federal funds have been used to acquire the land. So at this juncture, according to the analysis, it doesn't look like the Uniform Relocation Act would be required. But what Western Reserve Land Conservancy is exploring is voluntarily complying with it, because in fact it is a roadmap to get to just figures, and to, for as Mr. Hart mentioned, the one resident, you know, didn't have a reasonable figure of what it would take to relocate. The URA is a roadmap, and it is our hope that the Western Reserve Land Conservancy will be complying with the URA, which will be a very reasonable approach to looking at the figures that would be just.
I understand.
Is it fair to say to the public that from the standpoint of Metro Parks, unless and until the Conservancy does follow that Relocation Act, if not to letter, certainly in spirit, we're not interested?
Thank you for that statement, Commissioner. And that has been the sentiment that we have conveyed to the Western Reserve. And they have looked at that very favorably. And it is our hope that the board, you know, also agrees with that approach. It makes the most sense and provides those formulas that we don't have to guess over.
There's equity, and that's really
that's right. Critical. That's you. Right.
I'm sorry, sir. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Patrick O'Connor, and I live in Rocky River. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts with you today. And thank you for your stewardship of our parks. You have carried forward the visionary leadership that is the North Star of the Metro Parks, first exemplified by William A. Stinchcomb. It would be a shame if this history of noble and civic leadership should be sullied if the Metro Parks did not exert their influence in facilitating a just and equitable solution with our neighbors who call Euclid Beach Mobile Park home their home. In particular, I request the Metro Parks Board of Commissioners implore the Western Reserve Land Conservancy to negotiate with our neighbors in good faith. In other words, do not employ the divide and conquer strategy. The community of neighbors who call Euclid Beach Mobile Park home their home is organized, and their many voices are united. Please instruct the Western Reserve Land Conservancy to include the united residents of Euclid Beach in all negotiations to ensure a just and equitable solution. The neighbors who fund the Metro Parks expect no less. Thank you.
Thank you. We agree. Any more? All right. Information briefing.
Very first one we have is the 2023 National Procurement Institute, otherwise known as NPI, Achievement of Excellence Award. This procurement team, during its 28th annual Achievement of Excellence in Procurement Award in the National Procurement Institute. This is the 13th consecutive time, 14th overall, that the procurement department has won this award. It is based on best practices, innovation, professionalism, e-procurement, productivity, and leadership in the procurement function. We are one of only two agencies in Ohio and one of only 25 special park districts in the U.S. and Canada will win the award. So I'd like to recognize Director Charlie Russell under Wade's leadership there to be congratulated. Let's give them a round of applause. I think Charlie's busy buying things, so he's back at it. The next is the history moment. We were able to bring that back, making a splash. We just finished a very successful swim season. Christy Moore's, under her leadership, They have done just a phenomenal job getting lifeguards and continuing the tradition of many swimming locations that have been guarded through Cleveland Metro Parks through the years. So, Judy?
Thank you, Brian. Thank you. Good morning, commissioners. I thought it would be fun to end up the summer by looking at a little bit of a history of swimming in the Metro Parks. But I'm going to start with just this, which of course now is our park, but wasn't at the time. The first public swimming pool or city public swimming pool in Cleveland happened to be at Garfield in 1916. You notice it had a sandy beach by it because people were used to going to the beach to go swimming. So this was a beginning of a different kind of swimming. So I just kind of wanted to put that up there. But also, of course, whoops, let's go forward, not backwards. Of course, people had been swimming in Cleveland for many years before. This is one of my favorite postcards of people at a joyride at Edgewater. These ladies are having a good time there. Again, a park that was not ours at the time, but is now. So what about us? Well, in 1925, Cleveland Metro Parks, or the Metropolitan Park Board at the time, got their first bit of land where there was a new public beach proposed, as you see from this picture, which was, of course, Huntington Reservation. So some of the earliest pictures we have of it before people were actually swimming there. You notice it looks fairly similar, right? That, I mean, we did that pump house just went away a couple of years ago, and the water tower is still there and looking beautiful with all of its new renovations. The interesting thing is I don't have a lot of pictures from the era about people swimming there, but this is how popular it was because this is a picture of the parking area from circa 1928. So it immediately became a very, very popular place. And we did have lifeguards there. And these are a few pictures of them. The gentleman over there on the right, his son graciously loaned me all of his photo albums for me to scan. So we have, and this guy, he was a member of the CCC, and then he was also a lifeguard. So we have these beautiful pictures of the lifeguards there. So moving a little bit further south, the next swimming area that the Metro Parks was invested in was, of course, the land given to us by John F. Johnson. His barn is still standing there in 1925 or 26. It's a little bit iffy, but by 1927, they had built this dam and created Hinkley Lake, which, of course, has a swimming area down under the spillway. All right, why are we not, there we go. This is a picture of, notice it says no dogs allowed, so just so you know. This is a picture of the swimming area in 1927. And then the interesting thing about the next couple of places I'm going to talk about, just like Hinkley, that lake was created by damming up the east branch of the Rocky River. These are all along the Rocky River. So this is, of course, the old mill at Albion, or as we know it, Bonnie Park. This picture is taken about 1910, when the mill was still there, the bridge was still there, and you can see the dam. And in the late 20s, a gentleman named Klein, Dr. Klein, put up a private picnic and swimming area there, again, using the dam that had already been there for the mill. And you can kind of see a little boathouse in the back there. And then we took this over in 1932 and throughout the next few years used WPA work to create a swimming pool. It literally had concrete sides on it, but it's still the river. Unlike the spillway at the dam over at Hinkley, this one actually uses what would be the dammed up area of the river to create this pool. And this is one of my favorite pictures up there of these kids sitting there on the wall. There's two girls and about five guys, all in their bathing suits. And other than the hair on the girls and their bathing suits, it could be any number of teenage kids today sitting by a pool. Further north in the lagoon area in Rocky River, this was briefly a swimming area. They didn't do as much
manipulation of the river there, like they did down at Bonnie Park with the concrete walls and so forth. But it still had a bit of a retaining wall there, and people would swim in the lagoon, and it was an official area. You can see the platform, and you can see the lifeguard sitting in the chair there. And then, of course, Wallace Lake, which is also technically part of the Rocky River area, but also the old quarries in Berea. And there were already kids swimming in these quarries as they filled with natural water. So the thought was, why don't we go ahead and turn it into an official lake and swimming area? And of course, this is Lake Wallace in its early years. It's not as crowded nowadays with so many swimmers, but at one point in time, it was really crowded. Evidently, this was a very, very hot day in 1951, well, July 20th, and 7,000 people came to Wallace Lake, if you can imagine. This is a little different area. Of course, in 1976, we bought from the Bonesi, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, Bonesi family, an area that included Ledge Lake, Ledge Lake Pool. We did not build this pool. We're not normally in the business of doing that. But we sort of, it came with the rest of the property. When this was built in 1965, it was supposedly one of the largest pools in Ohio, if not the country. So it's a really, really big pool for its time. Of course, it's been, it doesn't have that record anymore, but it's still a very nice large pool. So so that's the sort of the last area that we got before. I think my batteries are dying here. There we go. Whoops. Before we got, of course, the lakefront. And starting over on the east at Euclid Beach, this was the bathhouse as it looked and the swimming area then. And of course, this is a more modern picture of what we've been accomplished over at Euclid Beach. And this is Edgewater. This is the bathhouse designed by our dear William Stinchcomb in 1912. I am told that up to 10,000 people could utilize that during a day. And of course, still a super popular swimming area. So, in conclusion, as we go into the dog days of summer here and end up, I hope people still have a little bit of chance to get out there. And when it's so hot that even William Stinchcomb took his jacket off, this is the only picture of him without a jacket on. So we know that was a hot day. So we hope that people have had a chance to get out there like these kids and have some fun in the Metro Parks swimming areas as they are today. Thank you.
Judy, can I ask a question about the dog coming out of the swimming pool? Yes. That's kind of interesting. Is that, so that was legal back then?
Well, that was just a few years ago before COVID. We used to do it at the end of the summer at Ledge Lake Pool. It was, does somebody remember the name of it?
Doggy Pool.
Doggy Day, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a week of cleaning.
So, yes, I know.
Very good.
Yeah. But actually, they did do it. They do that. I know. I don't think they did Ledge Lake Pool until we. I don't know when we started that, but I know it ended up during COVID. So, but I couldn't resist that picture because it was so dark.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judy. Excellent update. The next is the natural resources update. The adaptive hunt drift fence technique.
Drift.
Morning, Jen.
Good morning. I am pleased to introduce you to Dr. Nathan Beyer. He's one of our newer staff members. He's been with us for about a year and a half, came to us after doing some postdoctoral studies at the University of Nevada, Reno. And he's going to just share a unique survey technique for us.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Jen. Just making sure this works as I thought. Excellent. So as Jen mentioned, I'm coming to you all from Nevada, at least initially, but it's been a real pleasure being in Cleveland. I've found the city to be charming and absolutely love working for the parks. So as she mentioned, I will be presenting on what I think is a fairly novel survey technique for understanding elusive and rare wildlife. So in our second century of stewardship, conservation is a term that we enters into the equation a lot. We, one of our core missions is to conserve land, wildlife, and water to protect the beauty and ecological function and resilience of our region and the world. And I think we provide an excellent example of how to do that responsibly. And whether this includes, you know, doing aquatic work, measuring and monitoring our aquatic systems, vegetative work, or studying rare and elusive animals like the Blanding's turtle you see here, I think we do an exemplary job of doing that. Every time. All right. Oh, that's okay. All right, there we go. So a lot of those examples that I shared before are, you know, typically involve humans going out and actually collecting data. And that's what we call active monitoring. So this is basically when you think of going out and surveying streams, when you think of going out and electrofishing, trapping turtles, measuring plant communities. These are all sort of components of all of that that we'd call active monitoring. On the other end of the spectrum, and sort of implied by the existence of active monitoring, is what we call passive monitoring, which is basically methods that don't require any direct human involvement, at least once the technologies involved are actually deployed. So this includes, on the left here, we have acoustic detectors used for understanding birds and bats. And on the right, we have our familiar camera trap locked up to basically prevent vandalism. But you can obviously have a combination of both in any particular monitoring system. And as many of you all likely know, we have our own wildlife camera project, which falls under that passive monitoring schema. We call it the Focus on Wildlife Project, and it's one of the largest wildlife camera projects probably in the country. I think it's ranked second at present. And it's 205 cameras distributed deliberately in areas where we have existing plant community assessment plots. This is the distribution of those cameras. And just a brief example of some of the images that we get from them. They really are a wonderful resource for understanding our wildlife within our parks, whether they be avian or mammalian, or in rare cases, we get other sort of, occasionally, I think we've seen snakes being carried off and talons of a hawk or something like that. So technically reptiles show up too.
Is that an owl in the middle?
That is an owl, yes. And a turkey vulture there. So a little bit less attractive. But there's, by virtue of either their physiology or by virtue of their size, there's a lot of animals that we don't necessarily catch on those cameras. Small mammals is one great example. Just don't really know much about what our small mammal communities look like. But amphibians and reptiles, by virtue of being cold-blooded, typically don't show up on the cameras either. This is where a novel new approach called the adapted hunt drift fence technique comes into play. This paper was actually came out from lead author Scott Martin in 2017. He's actually a colleague of mine from my master's days in Richard Siegel's lab, last author on that paper. And I got to see him generating this method basically for use in coastal areas and near the Kennedy Space Center. In essence, the motivation in that case is no different than what it is here. It's very difficult to understand what small mammals, reptiles, and amphibians are doing in coastal areas and in forests in Ohio. You essentially have a fence that looks like this. This is a three-way fence, but you can have just a single linear fence as well, which is what I will be presenting on later, with a bucket trap that basically you take a bucket, turn it upside down, and attach this piece of plexiglass with a camera mounted in it. You have these two wings here that basically when animals hit the fence, they travel along it, hit the wings, go through the bucket, we get an image and they pass through. And this is just an example of some of the images that you sometimes see from that approach. So the sort of real impetus for this particular project though is an elusive species in Ohio known as the smooth green snake. This is actually a picture of myself handling one of them that we caught at one of our study areas, but this is one of only two we've seen this entire year. In Ohio, they are found in this sort of northeast to southwest swath that you can see here, and primarily found in grassy open areas. When you talk to a lot of herpetologists who have worked on snakes throughout the state, or herpetologist meaning, folks who study reptiles and amphibians. They have appeared to have declined over the past several decades, so that it is a state endangered species. And one thing I would note, so all of these dots indicate more recent observations, basically 1975 to present. There's a big aggregation of them in Northeast Ohio. And so for whatever reason, they seem to be doing really well in Northeast Ohio. In Cleveland Metro Parks, we find them primarily in Brecksville and Bedford, but that doesn't mean they aren't found in other areas because they are green and they're found in basically open grassy areas. And so I was fortunate enough to participate in some partner meetings in October 22 between ourselves, Ohio State University, Summit Metro Parks, and the National Park Service, under basically the motivation that it would appear that Northeast Ohio is sort of a holdout for this species, which ultimately culminated in a workshop that we held at the Brecksville Trailside Programming Center in April 2023, hosted by Greg Lips, who is one of the premier reptile and amphibian ecologists in the state, where we ultimately wound up constructing one of these fences at a site in Brecksville. And ultimately, through equipment loans from Ohio State University, primarily for those cameras, we wound up deploying a total of 3 new fences in Cleveland Metro Parks on top of 1 we already had. Summit Metro Parks deployed 2 new fences on top of 3 that they already had. And the National Park Service deployed 5 new fences on top of 7, another 2 that they had. So this totals out to 16 fences across data partners. And I was fortunate this past summer, so Ben actually forwarded along to me an internship opportunity called the Micro Internship Program through the Greater Cleveland Partnership. I was matched with this excellent micro intern, Jamie Penny, actually seen holding one of 2 smooth green snakes that we've actually found this season. She caught that and was pretty excited. And her project was basically taking the images from this project and using a program called Timelapse to annotate what sorts of animals are found on those, and using a platform called R to do some basic data analysis. And here's actually a picture of me and her and Baldwin-Wallace University professor, Andrew Merwin, at the 2023 Holden Search Symposium. So it's very proud to be there and seeing her presenting a poster on this work. And so in terms of findings to date, we found smooth green snakes at every site in which we've put out these drift fences, which is great. These were deliberately sites where we suspected they already were, but we got visual confirmation of green snakes in each case. In terms of when they were active, we primarily see them showing up between 10 o'clock and 4 a.m. and 4 o'clock p.m. And so that's already quite interesting. We often wind up actually seeing them under when we're doing other surveys in the very early morning between 8 and 10 a.m. So seems like they're actually cruising a lot more towards midday. And they were hoping to potentially use the amount to which we see smooth green snakes showing up on cameras as an index of population size, both for our sites and for data partner sites as well. But the great thing about this approach is it's not just a smooth green snake approach. We're getting information on other snake species like common garter snakes, the Case Brown snakes, which we can see their activity patterns a little bit broader. But we also get lots of information on small mammals. So we have a weasel here, a short-tailed shrew here, both of which you basically will almost certainly never see if you're out and just walking through the parks. And one thing I would note, if we compare the activity patterns between these taxa, they didn't necessarily line up the way I wanted it to, but that's okay. You wind up noticing that there's this big gap in activity around midday, which might show that these mammal communities and these snake communities are using different habitats at different times of day, or possibly avoiding each other.
So it looks like a weasel puts in a pretty long day though, doesn't it?
Yeah. I will say at this one site, at this one site, these weasels, like they're just in the cameras like the whole day. Like they're just coming and going and rolling around, and they're there during the day and they're at night. They go wild.
The weasels in the human population are about the same.
Yeah. You know, you might as well just put my active patterns up here, honestly. So in terms of going forward, the real hope with all this is that we can pull all of the data from these partners together to provide an unprecedented high resolution view of actually what good quality habitat looks like for smooth grain snakes and feed that forward into state level determinations of just how well they're doing. This is a really hard species to find. And so it's hard to separate rarity from an inability to detect an animal. Those are two very difficult things that we often deal with in our field. So hoping to separate those a bit more. We also have some projects actively focused on understanding our weasel populations. There are a few species of elusive weasels that we, in particular, the short-tailed weasel that we know almost nothing about, and they're quite rare. So there are some state level projects focused on that. And then in addition to that, one of the wonderful things about Adrift is that it costs about $1,000 or $1,000 per fence to put one out, just mostly from those wildlife cameras. But it's very modular. You put one out and it can stay there for 10 years, essentially, with some minimal maintenance. So it's a wonderful opportunity for expanded monitoring to supplement our already existing focus on wildlife project and fill in some of these data gaps for imperiled species. And with that, I'll basically end on this nice shot of some various species that we see on the cameras and welcome any questions.
Oh dear, thank you.
The smooth grain snake, why is that of such significance?
So that's a really fascinating question. And I'm going to do my best to not just go on and on about how much I like them. So smooth grain snakes in particular, most of the areas where you find them are in basically early successional open areas. A lot of these are old ag fields that have just basically started to transition to sort of scrubby oak dominated areas, which are understandably fairly rare in this part of Ohio. It's a lot of forests. One thing we don't necessarily know with them is, does that mean that they're an indicator species for these relatively rare patches of something more analogous to prairie that we might think of? And if that is the case, why is Northeast Ohio the portion of the state where they seem to be doing best? Throughout a lot of their range, you primarily see them in these open meadow areas, essentially. And so I think they really are typically thought of as like a stalwart for meadow protection, but they appear to be a lot more flexible than we think. And so I think they could be, more broadly though, I would say they appear to be quite sensitive to human disturbance in the present day and human development. So we often do look for taxa that are, or species that are indicative of the level of historical and current landscape development. And they seem like a good species for that as well.
Is that its normal size?
Yeah, they get quite small. They only get about yay big typically. So they're one of the smaller snakes we see, and that's sort of coincidentally about the size of a blade of grass. So oftentimes it's once one escapes, you just can't find it. It's gone forever, essentially.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
That was excellent. The next is the Cleveland Harbor Eastern Embayment Resilience Strategy, otherwise known as CHEERS. This is an update. We appreciate Kelly coming in. She has worked multiple years on this. This dates back to 2021, so we're happy to bring forward really the design, the evolution, the community feedback, and everything. So, Kelly.
Thank you, Brian. Commissioners, excited to be here to talk about a lot of updates that have happened since the last time we talked related to CHEERS. And I think this, I love starting kind of with the answer, you know, with this cover slide where we really look at what that vision will be along the east side lakefront. So a couple important things to point out. This is the federal breakwater. And so, of course, the fact that it ends here in the vicinity of East 55th is why we are all familiar with so much wave activity that really comes in off the lake and particularly impacts that stretch of Interstate 90. This is where the former power plant stood. This is South Gordon Park. And, you know, we do have beautiful parks right now along the lakefront, but what this vision does is more than doubles the park space. And then really importantly, it creates this protected cove where paddle sports can happen, where there's a natural shoreline. And then with this version, we also added kind of a lake facing We call that one the Bay, just to differentiate. But this is really the big picture that we're working toward. And the other piece of Cheers, look at the proximity to downtown and the trail route that we talked about this morning, the neighborhoods that we can serve. So it's really exciting to just, you know, tee up the project. This is the existing condition. And so it really, again, kind of familiarizes you with, you know, where the existing parks are. We are really using kind of the Cleveland Lakefront Nature Preserve as the eastern boundary, Burke Lakefront Airport there to the west. And then I think it's been mentioned over and over, but the importance of this partnership. We wouldn't be where we are today without the role of each of our partners and their support and their taking the lead on various aspects of the project. So the partners are, again, just crucial to the work that you're seeing. Back in 2022, with the receipt of additional grant funding, we did put out a call for consultants. And this is the consultant team that is going to be working on Cheers now and through the future. The lead consultant is Arup. They're an international consultant. One of their kind of key projects is the Sydney Opera House. They bring a lot of working with dredge and major engineering projects. And then we have great continuity with the remainder of the project team. WRT did a lot of the initial visioning and the initial study. KS Associates, I just can't speak highly enough of their expertise with coastal conditions and Lake Erie specifically. And then we have kind of our other specialists. But again, just to reiterate what resilience means to us, and it's just really a return to that triple bottom line, that these investments really bring about benefits in the realm of environment, economy, and community. And so everything we're trying to do with Cheers is really reinforcing that thought. You know, gone are the days where you could build a project that fulfills one need. And I think that's why we've seen a lot of traction with Cheers. So where are we? This timeline kind of really kind of shows how busy we've been for the past year. But with the funding that's been available through grants and the partner commitments, we've really been able to kind of put the pedal down on technical studies, additional engagement, and plan development. So we are roughly at about 30% design of the in-water structures for Cheers, which is kind of mind-boggling, you know, when you look at a project of that scale. But we're right on the cusp of submitting the plans to permitting agencies, probably early September. And I think Brian alluded to, you know, we have about 2 years probably to get through the regulatory process for Cheers, but we're really hopeful that we'll be able to break ground on an initial stage in 2025. And so that's when our kind of 20-year timeline would start kicking. So just to recap some of the engagement, as Brian mentioned, the initial study kicked off during COVID, and we were successful and creative with getting community engagement, but we didn't have large in-person gatherings. So this February, we hosted 2 in-person gatherings. So it was really fun and dynamic to get folks out, get folks talking about the project, and really kind of drilling into more of these details and more of the key features that the community wants to see. And, you know, so we've had pretty detailed discussions on a lot of these aspects, and so much of our engagement is really driven to the community level. We want the project to directly benefit existing residents. Of course, it's the lakefront and it will be a regional draw, but again, you know, our stated focus really is to that adjacent neighborhood. And this illustration kind of shows why. It's kind of a rough diagram, but if you look at this green boundary, that's Gordon, what the former Gordon Park footprint, and then the lakefront was here. And so you see, not only did Interstate 90 divide the park from the water, it also really kind of divided the park areas, you know, from themselves, and then this interchange. So what we're hearing from people, and I think it's really important to understand kind of what the community had before the highway was constructed. You know, this one really hit home with me. I remember before I-90, my brothers and I would run across the road and go to the lake almost every day. And, you know, that just doesn't happen now. And even if you get to the edge of the water, it's been filled so much that there's a steep drop off and you can't touch the water. So to me, that's kind of the real import of Cheers. So one of the steps we've also undertaken, representatives from each partner, we visited New York and our kind of consultant team met us there. Some of them are based there. And we went to visit other projects they had been involved with. And so we were able to see, you know, no single project that we saw, you know, replicates Cheers, but we can draw inspiration and knowledge from how these different parks work. And, you know, whether it's a fluctuating coastal wetland that we'll be having, you know, we won't be fluctuating with tides. It'll be more seasonal year-to-year water levels. Or Brooklyn Bridge Park was implemented over a number of years. And so we took some lessons about, you know, how do you activate and phase a park before the full build out occurs. So a lot of interesting discussions. And we also met with folks to really help guide us, and the work needs to start now, but how do we prevent displacement with the existing neighborhood? Because we want investment in the neighborhood, we want a vibrant neighborhood, but we want the existing residents to get to stay. So that work is underway and really kind of led by some of our partners that are more expert in that, but you know, that is a component of Cheers. So as we look to refine the plan, we still stuck to these and still heard the same thing, you know, these three main themes: connecting with nature, touching the water, and then playing at the shore, you know, really activating this park. So the result from that engagement, we kind of charted out, you know, what we were hearing and the kind of the size of the block relates to, you know, what residents, what the community wants to see. So an example is we heard a lot about biking and walking trails. We heard a lot about fishing. And so we kind of distributed that through the site. And then kind of on a parallel track, the technical side. So we're also laying the groundwork to be able to go through these permits. We need to go through the Federal Environmental Management Act. Is that FEMA? So, you know, federal process, because it will be a federal action working in the lake. So the historical evaluation, the ecological evaluation, our ecological team visited kind of reference sites along Lake Erie, some of which were natural and some of which were created with dredge. And our colleagues here in Natural Resources have been an amazing asset to the project team, really helping direct that work with that vision for the end use. Thank you, Jen and team. And so, you know, just in a general sense, what's the shoreline condition? What's that emergent kind of intermediate condition? And then what's the upland condition? So, you know, we'll continue to detail that out and delve into that more, and then also kind of impact that with the programmed user areas. And so this is kind of cool. The top illustration shows wave height, and the bottom one shows the period between the waves. And so you see how it goes from a calm lake to hopefully this will, yeah, just, so this is just kind of some of the cool technological work that's happened. But you see when it all turns red. So, you know, we're working to prevent that, you know, the red from happening on a most simplistic level.
The wave period then is higher is longer is worse.
Yes, I just go by the basics of the red. So
yeah,
experts to talk about the details there.
Danger.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So again, just to give a sense of the amount of coordination and permitting that is required, we do have some, you know, a pretty extensive list. So the Army Corps of Engineers, since we are building in the lake, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, Ohio EPA, the Coast Guard, and then I don't even, I think FAA isn't even on this list, but the proximity to Burke. So I don't want to underplay that it is a complex period that we're entering, but we're really hopeful that 2 years from now we can stand here with permits in hand. So then this is just, you know, a reminder of what the plan, kind of the footprint used to look like, where we were building out from the shore, but and then we were doing kind of this offshore major island. And through that input and the more technical information, we really wanted to consider a lot of these other aspects. So the cost of the breakwater is one of the major cost drivers. And so are there ways that we could reduce that? Can we get more ecological benefit? How do we look at water quality and long-term management actions? And then, you know, just the programmatic, the connectivity, both within the park and to the neighbor, to the neighborhood. And so this is really that revised plan where we've kind of sculpted it a bit more. And again, this is with input from throughout the Metro Parks team, which is really appreciated, that we're really all around the table kind of figuring out what's going to work best, what's going to be sustainable for our team to manage, and then where are some of the other advantages. So I'm really pleased with where the plan has taken us. The next slide I'll show you is just a quick, and I tell people, I'm sure it's going to change, but it's a quick vision of how we can implement the project. And so what you'll see is the graphic will begin here on the western edge and begin constructing that major structure of that outer breakwater all across here. And then while parts of that are going on, you'll see the filling of these various kind of blocks, and each of those equates to about 2 years of dredge material. So it does really kind of line up with the cycle. Okay, it wasn't the next slide, maybe one more. So here's the animation. Thank you, David. So you see that kind of heavy duty breakwater being constructed. And so, you know, both the quantities, the materials, the time of construction have been given a lot of thought, but we do want some leeway that a different puzzle piece may go in first.
But the break, Kelly, the break wall goes in first.
Field.
Yeah, okay.
It does, but it doesn't all have to be built at once. So we kind of have this on one side to envision how to build it, but then we have those funding opportunities coming along, and so we're kind of mixing and matching how that really gets built.
But the protection the government wants is sort of right in the middle there, right where the power plant used to be, where the Northeasters.
We feel like we can really make a case for that. Again, this is just another inventory of kind of the quantities, but I think we'll jump right into the protect. And you're absolutely right, Commissioner Moore. You know, when we talk to the ODOT people, they kind of elbow each other and say, yeah, remember, that's where we had to bring the plows out in the summer to scrape the fish off the road, which is a pretty dramatic image, right? But, you know, that overspray, we all know how that affects Interstate 90. But this is that vision for the PROTECT grant that was mentioned earlier. So it's this highlighted segment, which is just under 1,000 feet. And that most directly aligns with the existing shoreline here. Here's the edge of East 55. Yeah. And we have modeling to show this too, but here's Interstate 90. And so we're really making the case to the Federal Highway Administration that, you know, this is a good solution if you build this. And oh, by the way, that also really enables us to construct. Right, exactly. And you can see why it's an expensive project. This is, I should highlight the water level. This is roughly the surface level, the water surface. And so that water is about 30 feet deep. And so it's a pretty major structure. And then we'll come along and build the aisle kind of on the interior side of that. But also constructing that outer heavy duty wall then allows us to go in, and it's not as such a heavy lift to build out from the shore once we have that outer protection.
What?
So 44 million, I mean, how confident are we that that's?
It's really competitive. It's competitive. We're really thankful for ODOT for supporting. Not only are they putting, you know, 50% of the required match toward it. They've helped with some of the benefit cost analysis studies, and it's the only PROTECT application that they're supporting for the state.
Wow.
However, it's a big ask. So we're not really sure, you know, where we're going to end up.
And is the $44 million then the savings you would get from not having to replace the break wall next across from the power plant?
Yeah, it's tough. It doesn't pencil out as well as you'd like for, you know, an exact one-to-one, you know, cost benefit. But once you add in all those other benefits that the overall project means, it's really impressive. And so, you know, this is one piece that we're, you know, hopeful that we will receive. And then I think Brian mentioned on Monday, we're going to, it's just a letter of intent, but we are going to submit to NOAA for a major project to do the initial stage just north of East 55th. And so
the staging of the fill is both functional for wave action and realistic on how they do it currently, but also then you can do programming as you build it up. So you're kind of coordinating that. That's pretty cool.
Exactly. And that's one reason we thought that this this area we kind of refer to as the view, because it'll have the great views out to the lake and then back to downtown. But this area will be really kind of logical for us to program early because it's adjacent to our existing facilities at East 55th. So we can program it, we can activate it. And this, so PROTECT will likely, that segment would likely take 2 years to build. This segment would likely take 5. And they could be going in parallel with one another, or, you know, there's a lot of flexibility there. So the request for the NOAA grant opportunity will be about $60 million, but there is not a match associated with that. But to think that, you know, we're in such a great environment for funding opportunities right now, and that's one reason we were really grateful to be able to advance our work so far, so that we are shovel ready. You know, we say, give us the funds. By the time all the paperwork's done, it'll be 2025, and we'll be ready to go out there and build this improvement.
Fascinating. Wow.
And then kind of looking out another step or two beyond that, our partners with the port have been in conversations with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And since the Army Corps manages those essential dredge operations to maintain the federal ship channel, part of that is they need a place to place the dredge material. And so if we begin to build this framework,
this is handy.
We're pretty confident that the Army Corps will also see this as a solution to their needs as far as a location to place the dredge material, which could finance a lot of the other.
Is there an issue with transport costs like there is on land?
This is the most efficient because they can just barge it over, and it's the most, you know, it has the lowest like carbon footprint and everything else to be able to, you know, gain the dredge at the river and bring it here. So again,
improving water quality and habitat at the same time.
Exactly. So it's a pretty, you know, it's exciting to really see how these puzzle pieces are coming together and these funding opportunities. So, you know, we're really hopeful that we'll have success bringing in the funds.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great. Excellent updates.
Very good.
That was the last information briefing item. There is no old business. The next regularly scheduled meeting in the boardroom is September 21st, and there is an executive session.
Is there a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing the purchase and acquisition of real property?
So moved.
Seconded.
Bruce Rinker.
Aye.
Dan Moore.
Yes.
And that concludes our business. Thank you very much.
Motion to adjourn.
We are back from executive session. No further business. I need a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor? Aye. We're out of here.